This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Russia is mobilizing at least 300,000 more troops to fight in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin is staging what the U.S. is calling sham referendum votes in Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine. The votes are intended to show public support for annexation into Russia, but Ukrainians have reported armed Russian troops going door to door to collect votes. Russia has faced pushback domestically for its mobilization effort with anti-war demonstrations and many military-age men reportedly fleeing the country. Yoshiko Herrera is a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's teaching a new class this fall all about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with this call-up, this mobilization. 300,000 reserve troops, apparently with military background, at least according to the announcement, it may be casting a wider net in reality. What do you make of that move?
Yeah, I think this is a delayed strategy, and it probably isn't going to help very much, but it potentially could cause a lot of domestic unrest within Russia. I think the reason for the lack of calling this a war and having a full-scale mobilization earlier is that the regime was concerned they didn't have the public support that they needed for a mobilization to work. And I think the calling for a partial mobilization is sort of a half measure, acknowledging that weakness, and the protests that we see just provide evidence that indeed they don't have the support that they need.
That move comes as there's this referendum, as it's being described by the Russians, in territory they currently control in Ukraine, provinces from the initial separatist provinces that Russia had backed, kind of making a corridor to Crimea. Do you see any legitimacy in this vote at all?
No, there's no legitimacy. I think it's good to even call them sham referenda or pseudo referenda because they're not free and fair in any sense of the word. And they are an attempt by Russia to make it look like they have some level of popular support in those regions, possibly as a precursor to annexation of those regions into Russia, which would then allow Russia to say that it's their territory, not Ukraine, that is where the fighting is. But I think that externally, everybody understands exactly what's going on. And I don't think there's going to be hardly any countries that recognize the legitimacy. I mean, even Serbia is not on board with it. A longtime ally of Russia.
The apparent Russian goal of this invasion seems to have changed. Initially, it seemed like it was going to be a very fast, overwhelming attack. The expectation, it seemed like, from the Russian military and political leadership was that the Zelensky regime in Ukraine would collapse, the military resistance would dry up really quickly. Obviously, that didn't happen. Now we have this focus on eastern and southeastern Ukraine. What's happening there now?
Yeah, well, as you said, the goals have shifted because they haven't been able to achieve any of the military goals. They have been underprepared and have misunderstood both the Ukrainian and international response every step of the way. I think they're getting somewhat desperate after the big losses a few weeks ago around Kharkiv region. Now the Russians are trying to hold on to land that is connected to Russia and goes along the southeastern shore of Ukraine connecting to Crimea. So the four places where the referenda are places where Russia would have a so-called land corridor to Crimea. But I think that the Ukrainian military is currently working on liberating Kherson, one of the provinces. And so I don't think this strategy, I mean, that's clearly what the Russians want at this point, is to at least hold on to these four regions. But I don't think just because they want it means they're going to necessarily be successful.
We had this string of Ukrainian military successes more in the northern part of the region we're talking about now. I know you can't read too much into just a couple weeks of an ongoing war, but how big a deal was that?
Well, I think it's a big deal in terms of momentum and expectations, because morale and the will to fight is a big part of this war for both sides. On the Ukrainian side, they're extremely motivated. And they have a very strong will to protect the sovereignty, to protect the existence of their state. It's an existential war for Ukraine, literally. So people are very motivated to fight. And so a victory like that in Kharkiv, where they're actually able to push back Russian troops, is important to show people that all of the death, destruction, damage to buildings, etc., that there may, you know, that that victory is possible because they're able to liberate certain areas. On the flip side of it, I think the morale and will to fight on the Russian side has always been low because there's no obvious reason for this war. The defeat, I think, is seriously damaging for Russian morale. And it doesn't help with the recruitment to say, look, we sustained these incredible losses because our military isn't very good. Come fight with us now. It's not a very compelling message.
We're talking to Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, Russia expert there, looking at the latest news from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko, we've talked in the past about how it can be difficult to assess public opinion in a place like Russia. That said, from the demonstrations, from some potential inductees to the Russian military voting with their feet and showing up in Istanbul and elsewhere, what do you make of what we're seeing from the people within Russian borders?
Yeah, and you know, I just talked about this in my class today. We have a theory from Hirschman in political science that talks about exit voice and loyalty. And in response to this mobilization, in response to the war, you see exit with, you know, estimates of 200 to 300,000 people leaving in the last week to avoid the draft. People can also go hide at their dachas, hide in their apartments, just not show up. That's one. Voice in terms of protests, people going out on the street, that's very risky. Any interaction with police per se, touching a policeman, this can lead to an immediate prison sentence. So the protests are significant, I think. The regime has tried to silence people, to make people think that protest is futile, that there's nothing that can be done, that they hold all the power. But nevertheless, you're seeing some people taking risks to go out and protest. And of course, there are some regime supporters, so there is some loyalty. But there's also the context of the regions, the non-Russian regions, ethnically non-Russian regions or poor regions. These tend to be places where there's more authoritarian control of regional officials over the population. And so people may feel they don't have any choice but to show up and join. But nevertheless, the whole reason I think that mobilization is dangerous for the Putin regime is that everything else they do is about reducing the power of the individual. So with voting, by having fraudulent elections, by not allowing candidates you actually want to run, the power of an individual to vote and affect change is very, very limited. It's almost zero at this point in Russia. But with mobilization, the power is squarely back on the individual. That person either shows up or they don't, and they either fight or they don't. And the regime cannot lie their way out of this. They can lie about the number of recruits, lie about how well the mobilization is going, but that doesn't actually get them dedicated human beings willing to risk their lives for the regime. And so the mobilization has shifted the power to individuals who are able to make these choices about whether to show up, and if they do show up, to fight, or whether to leave the country altogether.
Yoshiko, one question that I'm kind of curious about. There's been some suggestion all along that Putin and Russian leadership have tried to make sure that the burden of this war isn't falling on the critical cities of Moscow and St. Petersburg, recruiting people or sending troops from, as you mentioned, minority areas, lower income areas. Is that changing now with this new recruitment drive, this new call up?
I think what's not clear is whether it's a particular strategy by the regime, let's say, to lessen the requirements or exemptions for these big cities, or whether the big city administrations are simply not willing to go along with it. What we're seeing is that the regions most loyal to Putin, the ones most dependent on money and political support, are the ones sending in the recruits. But this could be about capacity, that the state has the ability to compel some of these regions and some municipal authorities to meet their targets. And others, they just don't have that power. I don't see the Russian authorities, for example, having a lot of power over, say, the city of Yekaterinburg, where they arrested a very popular former mayor recently. So I think that the strategy, if there is a strategy, is to sort of get the recruits where you can. But I don't think they've actually thought it through and figured out how to compel people who don't want to agree to participate.
Of course, this is a destructive war for the militaries on both sides, for the Ukrainian civilian population. Still, a lot of people nowhere near their homes at this point. How does this end? Given the goals of both sides, Russia wanting to take big parts of Ukraine still, Ukraine obviously not wanting to give those up, how do we get from here to a peaceful resolution?
Yeah, this is a very difficult question. I think that from all we can see about both sides are resolved to continue to fight. Ukrainians are very dedicated to keeping their territory, to maintaining the existence of their state. And it makes sense because of the war crimes and the things that we have seen in Russian-occupied areas. For Ukrainians to give up territory, what peace means, it means subjecting your citizens to torture and war crimes. And that's not a peace that a lot of Ukrainians or people externally are willing to accept. And on the Russian side, they see this also as vitally important for their status, for the security of the regime in terms of maintaining its veneer of power. I mean, the regime rests on a lot of fear, and that fear is because people have to think it's powerful, a little bit like the Wizard of Oz, but a horrible, destructive sort of wizard. So you have to maintain the idea that you're in control and you're powerful. And so the cracks in the mobilization process and the weakness in the fighting are destructive for the regime. And that's, I think, going to make Putin more resolved to continue. So unfortunately, I think that the only possibility for a real peace is through a military defeat of Russia. And that looks like it's going to take some time.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Yoshiko Herrera, political science professor at UW-Madison, where she teaches about Russian and post-communist politics. She was with us today looking at Russia's mobilization of more troops and Putin's efforts to hold sham referendum votes for annexation of a big chunk of eastern and southern Ukraine. Right now, it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Member Drive. Larry Mueller joins me now. Your gift right now is so important because gifts from people like you are the largest source of funding for WPR programs. Central Time and all the shows you count on are possible thanks to your support. Give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Just a few minutes left in this hour, and we're looking for four more people to join in. So make your gift to support the programs you enjoy and rely on every day.
WPR programs are listener-powered. That means your gift right now makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, this last segment was really fascinating for me, Yoshiko, talking about the Russian invasion and the partial mobilization. What I really hadn't heard about or thought much about was how different parts of the country are reacting to this mobilization and what's going on in the minds of some Russians. It's a really important information, and these are the kinds of conversations you count on from Central Time.
WPR is listener-supported, and that means your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes this and all the conversations you tune in for every day possible. Choose the amount that works for you, and then make your gift.
And this member drive, you can broadcast your love for WPR with two new thank you gifts. And for the WPR tote bag, when you give $10 a month, or a pair of WPR socks when you give $15 a month, and better yet, you can get both thank you gifts when you give 20 bucks a month. Your love for Wisconsin and public radio will be on full display, and you'll ensure the entire community has access to essential news and entertainment with your gift. Ask for your WPR Duo right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Well, I figured it was important for me to become a sustaining member because I needed to give back. I really enjoy the programs here. I get to hear it every day, and I figured there's buy-in. When I'm a sustainer, I enjoy driving to work, leaving work, being at home, even going to bed listening to WPR. Most media that you hear now, most programs don't have that objectivity that WPR offers. I enjoy all the shows, and I figure you gotta let your money talk. I'm Eben from Appleton, Wisconsin. I encourage you to join me in sustaining Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 at Central Time. The Fall Member Drive, Rob Ferret here with Larry Mueller. Listener support is the biggest source of funding for the WPR programs you count on. That's why your gift of $10 a month or $100 a month, whatever amount you choose, really does make a big impact.
And you might think that you don't have to support WPR because somebody else is. Well, WPR has been around for years because thousands of people have made the decision to support something that's important to them.
Now it's time for you to make that decision. Many first-time donors will give $10 or $20 a month. You choose what works best for you. Give now. It's time at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Rob's right. As a donor, you get to decide how much to give, and maybe $100 or $200 a month is the right amount for you.
That might be what you spend every month on takeout food or entertainment, for example. You name it. It's stuff you enjoy and stuff that makes life better, just like listening to WPR. The important thing is that you decide the amount that's right for you, then make your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're making progress and we're really close. When two more people support the WPR programs in the next few minutes, we'll meet our goal. WPR is listener powered, and that's why your gift right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 is so important.
Let the world know WPR is your source for information and inspiration with the new WPR tote bag and socks. Ask for both, actually all three, because I think you get two socks. Not just one sock. So ask for it all when you give $20 a month or more with radio and Wisconsin-inspired designs. Your WPR pride is going to be on full display. Support the quality news and entertainment you count on. Ask for the tote bag and socks when you give. $20 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.